Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. We have some great spring topics to talk with you on the show today. With us are Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Lisa, great to have you back.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
And Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Brian, good to have you back as well.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
We'll talk about starting seeds. We'll talk about pruning trees and shrubs. We can hit some disease issues maybe from last year. And, well, you know what? Whatever gardening questions on your mind, we'll try to cover it. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. And I see we're already getting some calls online here, but maybe we can talk seeds for just a minute. We talked about it on the show a few weeks back, but I think it bears repeating, Lisa. Certainly, we're all getting kind of eager to get out there and get some gardening in, but when's the right time to start those seeds?
Well, it depends on the species that we're talking about and, of course, where you are located, because you want to have your plants ready to go out when you're past the last frost date. But you don't want to start them too soon or they're going to get too big and leggy. And it also depends on the crop. I usually, in the southern part of Wisconsin, we start a lot of our vegetable seeds around the middle of March or even the end of March. But there are some species like basil, for example, that take a long time to germinate. So those are often started a little earlier.
Yeah. This time of year, grow lights still necessary or... maybe a south-facing window?
I am a big proponent. Yeah, I like using grow lights. You have a lot better control over the directionality of the light because it's shining right down instead of having to flip your trays around so that you don't get the phototropic response of the plants leaning towards a window light. But that being said, windows can work for a number of different crops.
Yeah. And I think one of the issues that comes to my mind when I think about starting seeds indoors is watering. And I think sometimes we may do too much of it. Other times maybe we forget it gets too dry. But what about watering?
Yeah, well, here's a good segue for Brian. As you mentioned, sometimes people tend to overwater those seeds, and that can create an anaerobic environment and give us some nasty sorts of damping off and other kinds of root rot. You have to just be really vigilant. It's difficult for me to say exactly how much water you should use because I don't know how big your containers are going to be and the type of media, but you don't want things to dry out, but you don't want them to be sitting in water either.
Yeah, Brian, maybe chime in here.
Yeah, that's exactly the case. My concern, of course, is disease problems. And I have to say, I do not have an overwatering problem in my household. I deal with drought stress all the time because I don't water enough. But most people, I think, tend to overwater. And also, people are oftentimes starting seeds in the basement where it's a little bit cooler. And that combination of cool and wet tends to be very favorable for organisms that can be in the soil that can cause what's called damping off. So the seedlings will come up. All of a sudden, you'll see that base of the stem collapse. And then the plants will fall over onto the soil surface. So definitely you need to keep, I always tell folks, give the plants enough water to keep them alive, but keep them on the dry side so that these organisms are not active.
We have callers online. Every one of our lines are full. So let's take a call. Audrey in Minocqua, we'll go to you. Hi, Audrey.
Hello. Hi. Thanks.
Hi. Oh.
I have a question about straw bale gardening.
Okay.
Last year, we started the first time with 10 bales. We're up here in Minocqua. I followed the directions to the T, so the bales were all, you know, beautifully loaded with the fertilizer. Some things did better than others, so we're in the learning process. But my question is this. By the end of the season, they were growing a lot of grass. We didn't do anything with them over the winter. We didn't cover them. They're still in the garden because I didn't know what to do with them. So my question is, should I dispose of those bales? Was it the fault of the bale that the grass grew out of them so heavily? And what can I do because they are so just full of the fertilizer? Is there anything I can do with them?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Lisa, you want to comment?
Yeah, boy, sounds like you got some weedy straw is my guess.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like to me.
It's a problem. Yeah, I hate to have you, you know, dispose of that, but I'm also worried that depending on the type of grass that's in there, whether it's something that's going to overwinter and cause you weed problems later if you distribute that material on your garden or something. Did you pull any of the grass last year? Did it have really hard to pull roots on it that were bright white with a really sharp point on the ends?
No, it wasn't like a crabgrass. It was like actual nice green grass. And I couldn't figure out where it was coming from. And now when I think about starting up again, I'm like, oh gosh, I don't want grass growing everywhere. So I think I'm going to have to dispose of them.
Well, you would, you know, one thing you would be able to do would be to compost it. I mean, that is really good material. You'd hate to get rid of that. Do you have a compost pile?
I don't have a pile, but I can certainly make one. We have a compost bin, but it's not nearly big enough for this. So you suggest just making a nice compost out of it.
I would. I mean, you're going to get some great, you know, typically if you don't have a weedy, you know, if you don't have a weedy or bale, and the bale is still pretty good, you could use that same bale again the next year. Most of the times when I've had it, they're never in good enough shape by the end of the season for me. So what I do is I just spread them out right on the same spot and put new bales over the top of them. But other people do it differently. But I would definitely, you want to hang on to that. That'd be great compost.
Yeah. Question, did you see broadleaf weeds or was it just this grassy material?
No, it was just grass. It was just all grassy.
Yeah. I'm almost wondering if in the production of the bale, it might have been from the actual material that was used to make the bale. So it could be some sort of grain crop, which are grasses. So it may be that you really don't have a weed problem, but it could be just from that material that the straw bale was made from.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. Are the bales in good shape?
Well, they were good enough so that I would want to try them again. I mean, they held together. But, yeah, this grass issue has kind of spoiled that thought for me. So I guess we'll compost it and get some new ones.
You know what? You know what I do, Audrey? I'd keep one or two of those bales.
Thought process?
If you want to compost, make sure it's 130 degrees and that you turn it a few times in order to get rid of those seeds if you decide to compost it.
Well, I'll do some research on that, and I think that's what I'm going to do. Thank you so much for your help.
All right. Thanks, Audrey. Appreciate it. Let's see. Anissa in Black Creek, your turn. Hi.
Hi. Beginner
what can
gardener,
I do for you?
I'm a beginner gardener, and I had great luck last year with my vegetable and perennial gardens. I'd like to start some seeds indoors for annuals and vegetables just to kind of keep the momentum going. I was wondering if you guys had any recommendations of any tried and true herbs, marigolds, flowers, vegetables that I can start indoors. I also have two little kids just to help have them get interested in gardening as well.
Okay, Lisa, do you want to give that a shot?
Sure, that's great that you're interested in having your kids help you. You mentioned marigolds. Marigolds are a surefire, pretty much foolproof crop. They usually are going to germinate within 7 days. So, and they're big enough that little kids can, you know, hold the seeds, and they're easy for them to plant. So that would definitely be one that you could start inside. If you want a quick crop inside, you can certainly try some lettuce, or you could try spinach, and both of those would work just fine. If you want to try the winter sown method, if you're interested in flowers, you might want to try some of the native seeds or wildflowers. The winter sown method is where you get a gallon jug of, say, milk, and when the milk is done, or maybe you have an empty vinegar container or an empty distilled water container, and you cut that so that the handle is a hinge. You're cutting it in half, and you're planting in the bottom. Of course, you have to make sure that there's holes in the bottom so that it drains, but you put your media in, and you sprinkle your seeds in and plant them as according to the directions on the pack. And then you put that outside. Now, most of the time we do that in, say, February, but I think you could do it now if you wanted to get something started right away that's outside. And seeds that need some kind of vernalization or cold period are really well suited to that sort of thing. There is actually a website, wintersown.org, if I recall correctly, that you can find more information on. But there's plenty of vegetables you can start inside too. Tomatoes are also pretty easy. If you're worried about not having warm enough conditions, you might want to stay away from peppers. Peppers are a little more difficult.
Yes, they are. I've had experience with a long time ago with planting peppers, my plants outside, just a little too early. And then I had plants, but no peppers. That's kind of an issue when it comes to peppers. Well, I'll tell you what, Lisa Johnson, Brian Huddleston are our guests today. It's great to have them with us. Jill Nadeau is our producer, Jana Rose Slice, our on-air producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. I wanted to mention UW Extension is conducting a survey on how listeners use our Garden Talk program. We'd love to have your help on that. We'd like you to complete a brief survey about today's show. It shouldn't take more than 1 or 2 minutes, and we hope you can fill that out. Just go to go.wisc.edu/radio and fill out this form. And your response, of course, are anonymous. And again, the place to go is go.wisc.edu/radio. Or if you didn't get that down, just go to our page, wpr.org/Larry, and we have a link there on the right-hand side of our page. So wpr.org/Larry. Your input really helps us in planning new topics for Garden Talk, among other things. So hope you'll follow with us on that. Well, we have more callers online, so let's go back to the phones and to Chris in Merrimack. Chris, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Love your program. I've got a question about, I bought some of those Heritage tomatoes. You had the owner of that company on Garden Talk a while ago, and I jumped at the bait. So I got some tomato seeds, and I'm wondering how soon I can start those indoors.
And you're in Merrimack. Okay. Well, I probably either Brian or Lisa, but Lisa, do you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah. Is my audio working okay now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Okay. I would say any time now, probably the middle of March to end of March, considering where you are, would be good. You usually want to plant those out in southern Wisconsin around the 20th of May, so you probably are going to want to get those started. Maybe around the 20th of March would be fine.
Okay. Chris, I hope that helps. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And by the way, when you walk by those plants every so often, just give them a little brush. Strengthen those stems. Give them a little shake once they get going.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
That always helps. Thanks, Chris. Joe in Janesville, your turn.
Yes, I have. I grow about 50 pepper plants, all different kinds of peppers. And the last few years, they turn black on me. It looks like they got aphids. And then once they get that, I have all kinds of bees and wasps around them. What can I do to solve that problem? Because if I just leave them, they'll just kind of go down and they'll die right off. I have tried like 7, but that only lasts like a couple of days. You know, you can't spray it that often. So any other suggestions I could do?
What do you think, Brian?
My concern is this is a more of an insect question, so maybe Lisa might want to pop in, but I'm wondering about things about floating row covers or something like that. Might not work with older plants. Lisa, you want to comment on that one? I suspect what the wasps and bees are coming in are for the honeydew from the aphids, so that's their feces, which is quite nutritious.
Yes. That's my guess, too, is that the feeding from the aphids and the honeydew that they generate from their sap-sucking activities is causing the black sooty mold, and that the wasps that you talked about are probably attracted to that honeydew. So it's probably an insect issue, and I think Brian's idea about floating row cover is fine, up until the point when they start to flower, and then, of course, you need to have pollination occur. So is this happening early in the season when you're noticing this, or is this happening later?
It's happening throughout the whole season.
Throughout the whole season. I'm wondering why you have so many aphids. That's interesting. Do you do good garden cleanup at the end of the season?
Yeah, but probably not as good as I could try a little bit more.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think where the aphids might be coming from. You said that you start your own peppers from seed?
Half I do and half I don't.
Okay, and you don't notice any difference in terms of which ones are getting the aphids?
No, there's no difference.
Hmm.
I would definitely inspect those plants that you're buying, though, before you purchase them. Sometimes you can bring in insect and disease problems from the garden center or from your local greenhouse. So definitely make sure those plants are really healthy looking and don't have any insects attached to them before you buy them.
Or if any of them that you start from seed are near house plants that might have any issues, that's a possibility as well. You can use neem oil for aphids, but you would have to obviously repeat it. And I wouldn't put it on once you've got the actual fruits developing, or flowers for that matter, either.
Hmm. So a few things to think about on the front end there, especially, Joe, I think making some good inspection of your own houseplants, but also the plants before you purchase them, you might be just bringing them in with those plants. Good luck.
Yeah, I was going to say insecticidal soaps, Lisa, would be another thing possibly to use for aphids as well.
Yeah, I was trying to think of the most, you know, benign thing that I could think of, which was neem. But yeah, insecticidal soap would be the next thing if that's not working. Neem works pretty well on soft-bodied insects, but it's not a bad idea also to rotate your control methods. So, yeah,
right.
I would try either one of those products and also try the floating row cover early in the season, but make sure you don't have aphids trapped underneath the underneath the floating row cover. That'll just multiply your issue.
There you go, Joe. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, by the way. Gardening question, give a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. Darlene in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Darlene.
Hi there, Larry. A number of weeks ago, someone called in on a Friday talking about having Virginia bluebells that were just all over her lawn, and she wanted to know how to get rid of them. And, I have Virginia bluebells. I didn't think it was anything of a problem. But then later on, someone else called in and said perhaps she has creeping something or other. And I missed
Charlie.
What it was.
Creeping Charlie would probably be what she might have mentioned, Darlene.
Well,
The other thing would be Siberian swill.
Yep, that's what I'm thinking.
What did you say?
It's called Siberian squill, and it's a little bulb that you can plant, but it spreads like crazy. I'm very fond of this because the very first research project I ever did back in high school was on this particular plant. But it's quite aggressive, and it will replace turf in lawns. It'll spread by seed. Also, it'll produce little bulblets that can be spread around as well. Squirrels and other animals can move it around. I think ants actually are involved in moving some of the seeds, and it will make a solid layer of the plant, and it has actually quite attractive, really deep blue flowers. It's a springtime plant, but it can overtake the lawn. And unfortunately, if it's really invasive, you'd probably have to go in. If you've got a lot of it and you really don't want it, you'd probably have to go in with a broad-spectrum herbicide and probably deal with it that way. You're left otherwise with trying to dig it up, which is virtually impossible to do once it gets established.
Yeah, I've had many conversations with our weed specialist about how to and what products to use to get rid of it. The only good thing, of course, is that it once it's done blooming and the leaves go away, it's gone. However, at that point, it has killed off some of your lawn, and so that's problematic. You're right, it is quite aggressive.
Yeah.
Guys, it isn't that. This looks like your regular Virginia bluebells, but it grows about 4 feet tall, and you can cut it off all summer, and it keeps coming back.
4 feet tall?
Yes.
Well, it's definitely not Virginia bluebells, then.
Yeah.
And that's an ephemeral, too. I mean, it dies in June. You said this is going all season long. It's blue flowers?
Well, you know, this is at my daughter's house. And when she first moved in there, the flowers looked more pinkish, though, I would say. But it kind of looked like Virginia bluebells. But it is not. She digs them out about every 2 weeks, and they keep coming back.
Wow, I'd love to see a picture of that.
Yeah,
where
I would
where
suggest
is
getting a digital photo and emailing that in to your county extension office and have someone try to ID it for you.
Okay.
Where is she located?
Well, she's located in Suamico here in Wisconsin.
Oh, she's in Wisconsin. Okay.
Yes.
Well, yeah, a picture or when they're up, take the plant itself in to the county extension office, and somebody there can probably get it identified for you. And once you know what it is, then you can kind of know how to deal with it once you know what it is.
Yeah, knowing your enemy is important.
Good luck, Darlene. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Ron in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I just picked up, tuned in when you ended the discussion about dealing with aphids. But this is something I've heard, that aphids alight on a plant, orient themselves by moving away from the sun, and that if as long as they get away from the sun, they know where to head to alight on a plant like a rose bush. So if your rose bush is in the ground, you might want to hang strips of aluminum foil on it, or if it's in a pot, put aluminum foil around the pot, because it will reflect sunlight on a sunny day, and the aphids become disoriented. I'm not making this up. This is something I heard, that they need to orient away from the sun. So if you hang anything reflective material on the plant or on the face, the pot, then they don't know how to orient themselves. They don't know how to where the plant is.
Hmm. Well, I hadn't heard that. I mean,
reflective mulches are sometimes used in aphid control. I'm not well versed in that area, though. But it did, when you were mentioning that, that did remind me that you can use yellow sticky cards to help monitor aphid populations, and it will catch some of them. But yeah, I know there are reflective mulches that are sometimes used. But I couldn't comment on the aluminum foil.
Well, that'd be a reflective mulch.
Yeah, it certainly would.
For sure. Thank you, Ron. Appreciate the call. John in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking the call. I just wanted to commiserate a little bit and explain possibly for the lady who called in with the grass in her mulch.
Okay.
The last year, mulch was very, very hard to come by, at least around here, so I ended up buying some compressed bales. They were packaged in plastic, very clean and nice to use, from a big box store. And I was thrilled when I got it home, and then I started using it. And I used some, for example, to mulch our strawberry beds. Well, 2 weeks later, we had grass growing up all over the place in those strawberry beds. I believe what it was, based on what happened to me, is that that straw was actually filled with wheat seed. And if I wanted to grow a lawn, I could just grow a wheat lawn by spreading that mulch.
Well, that's certainly a possibility, John. Thank you so much. So what was the end result? Did you wind up with, did they go away?
We were pulling grass out of our strawberry bed and some other areas where we put it for weeks.
Oh, dear.
I hadn't, you know, we've been gardening for a long time, over 30 years, and many years ago I made the mistake of getting hay and using hay as a mulch, and this straw was dirtier than any hay I had ever had.
Oh, dear.
Yep.
John, thanks for that warning. Appreciate your call.
You need
to, I guess you need to identify your bales for sure.
Well, yeah, and I'll make a follow-up comment on that as well. We have had problems on occasion if the crop that's being used to make the bales of hay has been treated with herbicides during production. Some of those herbicides can carry over and cause problems in the garden. Lots of times the herbicides being used are growth regulators like 2,4-D or dicamba, and certain vegetables, particularly tomatoes, are quite sensitive to very, very low levels of those herbicides. Mm. And you can have enough residues in the straw if you're using it as a mulch to cause some problems.
Mm.
More good information there. Thank you again, John. Let's take another call. Kathy in Viroqua, it's your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a maple tree in my yard that I'm concerned about. Woodpeckers and other birds have been pecking at one particular area on the trunk, so that now the bark is off on that area. And I had a more leaf prolific maple die a few years ago. And now there are other trees, pine trees, in the neighbor's yards that are either dead or dying. I'm wondering what we or I need to do or can do.
Yeah, the first thing I would do would be to take some digital photos of that. I would get them first to PJ Leash, our insect diagnostician, particularly the maple that you're talking about with the bird activity, because them coming to that tree would indicate to me that probably there's some insect activity in the tree, and the birds are probably going after larvae that are colonizing underneath the bark. And take some photos of the tree, close-ups of where you're seeing the bark coming off. I would take some shots farther out of the tree just to give a sense of what the tree looks like in the landscape, and then email those to PJ. His email is pleash, so pleesch at wisc.edu. And when you look at that tree as the trunk goes into the ground, does it widen as it hits the soil, or is it look like a telephone pole as it goes into the ground?
A little bit, I think.
Sorry? I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
I'm looking at it. It widens. Yeah, it's not.
Okay.
Okay, it flared out.
Okay, so that's good, because if it looked like a telephone pole, I would worry about overly deep planting, and that can set you up for things like girdling roots, which can stress the tree, and that can make the tree more attractive to insect pests. And I'm not quite sure what's going on with the pines in your neighborhood. That would be another thing. You might take some photos and send those to PJ. The other thing I would watch for in the spring and throughout the summer, look for any indication of mushrooms coming up around the base of those trees, your maple or those dead pines. There is a fungal disease called armillaria root disease, and that particular fungus does produce mushrooms. And it colonizes a tree, and then it grows these structures that look like roots, but they're fungal structures, grows those out into the soil looking for the roots of other trees, and that's kind of how it spreads from tree to tree. So that's a possibility as well. If you happen to see something that looked like that, you'd be welcome to contact me. My email is Huddleson, HUDELSON at WISC.edu. And we could talk a little bit more about what to do about that. It's a difficult disease to manage, quite frankly.
There you go, Kathy. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Just back to those plants that look like bluebells. We've had a few callers call in to say columbine might be the plant. Well, let's see. False campanella or creeping bellflower.
Campanula rapunculoides. That's still usually doesn't get 4 feet, but it does produce purple bell-like flowers, and it is a dreadful weed, and it can get almost anywhere. So that's a possibility.
Yeah,
it's very aggressive.
You can join in too, by the way. Oops, sorry. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email at ideas@wpr.org. Madeline in Mineral Point had wondered about dealing with lilac fungus. Is it safe to prune the lilacs now? And if so, how much should she prune?
Yeah, it depends on which fungus she's dealing with. But my guess, based on what we saw last year, there was a leaf disease that came in that was quite prevalent that tended to cause browning of the leaves from the bottom of the shrub up. And it's a fungus related to the one that causes similar symptoms on tomatoes. So it's a Septoria fungus. And with that one, we recommend really good cleanup of any of those leaves that have come off those shrubs. That's where the fungus is going to spend the winter. So that material needs to be burned if you're allowed to do that. You can bury it just to totally cover it with soil, prevent spores from getting into the air that can float around to your new leaves as they come out. Or if you're a good hot composter, the way Lisa was talking about earlier, you can compost that material. And then definitely I would get into those shrubs and thin them. So typically with thinning with lilacs, we suggest kind of taking a look at the shrub, find the largest diameter canes and remove about a third of those from the shrubs. That opens up the canopy, which allows for better airflow, and that tends to dry things more rapidly if the shrubs get wet. And it's really those wet conditions that are very favorable for these sorts of fungi to get established. So pruning is definitely a good thing, but you need to pair that with doing good fall or doing good cleanup in the spring. Make sure all those leaves are gone.
You know, they might have been talking about powdery mildew as well, and that's
If it's powdery mildew, that's a disease I totally ignore on lilac. It's a very cosmetic disease. That you'll get white growth on the leaves. Certainly, pruning and thinning will help prevent some of that. But in terms of severe diseases, powdery mildews on lilacs, lilac is the poster child for powdery mildew. It gets lots of it, and it doesn't really care. It doesn't do damage. So the lilacs live quite happily with powdery mildews typically.
A Pang in Brilliant email to ask about no-till farming. They use a plow. They use the plow 2 to 3 acres in the fall. The ground is heavy clay soil and rocky. Is no-till gardening the way to go, or should Pang stick to tilling the land each year?
Is this a commercial operation? Can you tell?
I think it's just I can't tell, but it sounds just like a very large garden to me, two to three acres.
Well, you certainly can do no-till. One of my colleagues, Claire Strader, is a huge proponent of using raised soil beds and then using cover crops in between the rows, and actually using cover crops on the raised bed parts when they're not in use, you know, so that over the winter you don't have bare soil. What she has done is, you know, she tilled it up once and then has just added a lot of organic matter every year to those beds and worked it in, and then again just made permanent paths and only gardened in those areas that she's adding the organic material to, so you don't compact it at all. But no-till is certainly a good thing to do to help inhibit erosion, and also it's better for the soil if you're not always tilling it. But if you've got super heavy clay, you'll probably have to add a lot of organic material to improve that soil over time.
Yeah, it makes good sense.
From a disease standpoint, my recommendation is it's great to do no-till. I agree with Lisa, but you have to be very, very careful with rotation when you're doing that, because if you end up planting the same crop in the same location and you're doing it into no-till, you tend to have an increase in disease problems. So it's very important to map out your garden and make sure you're not planting the same plant or related plants in the same spot every year. We have a really nice fact sheet on using rotation and also cover crops in the garden that's available at my clinic website, which is pddc.wisc.edu. It's in the fact sheet section. And that'll run you through how to use rotation and which plants are related to one another, so they're likely to get the same diseases. But yeah, I like no-till. It's just you have to be careful from a disease standpoint when you're doing that.
Yep.
And again, that's pddc.wisc.edu, correct?
That's correct.
Our guests today, Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW, Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston. Great to have them back. Certainly welcome your calls and comments as we move along today. And just again, a reminder, Extension is conducting a survey on how listeners use our Garden Talk program. Love to have you participate. It'll only take you a couple of minutes, 1 or 2 minutes to fill out, and we hope you'll do that. The place to go to fill it out at the end of the show is go.wisc.edu/radio, or just go to wpr.org/Larry, and you can find the link on our page there, and I hope you'll do that. Well, we have callers online, and Beth in Madison is up next. Hi, Beth.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, appreciate the call.
Okay, I have a question regarding my 30-year-old raspberry bed. It's raspberries, it bears in the spring and the fall. That's all I know about it in terms of its name. But the berries are getting smaller, and the crop is getting less. And I'm looking for some way to try and revitalize this bed, if possible.
Yeah, that may or may not be possible. My concern when you have an older raspberry bed, they tend to be pretty prone to virus diseases, and they can actually build up a lot of viruses over time, and that tends to cause smaller fruit, crumbly fruit. Plants usually maybe a little bit stunted. It's a little bit difficult, or it's basically impossible to get rid of those viruses. So basically starting a new bed over is about the only thing that you can do. Now, if it's not that, and it's just from them being, you know, very old bed, at least you have suggestions on kind of thinning or otherwise renovating a bed.
Yeah. When I agree with you, it's probably that 30 years is really super old for a raspberry bed. Also, if you have any black raspberries that are wild in the area, those tend to be places viruses can come from as well. I was thinking about crowding, too, might be an issue. The thing I'm worried about is if I tell you to divide and start over with that same plant material, if it does have a virus, then you're just multiplying your problem. You know, raspberries are not all that expensive, especially if you get them bare root in the spring. I would tend to plant them in a totally different location, if at all possible, and start over with some new vigorous varieties. And it's great if you're able to actually separate the fall bearing ones from the summer bearing ones in terms of being able to do proper pruning, because the summer bearing ones are on a 2-year life cycle, and the ones that bear later in the year are the fall bearing, and those are on a 1-year life cycle. So it makes the pruning really difficult, because you don't know, you know, whether you're pruning the right thing or not.
Yeah, makes good sense. Beth, thank you so much.
Yeah, but definitely don't reuse those plants if you're going to establish a new bed.
Start with new
materials. Yeah. And don't replant in the same area, because some of the viruses are actually nematode transmitted. These are small parasitic worms that are in the soil. And if you happen to have those and you put new plants in the same location, those nematodes will feed on the roots of the new plants and can potentially transmit the virus right away.
Hmm. There you go, Beth. A little work ahead of you this spring with getting a new bed going from the sound of it. Thank you so much for calling. John in Watertown, your turn. Hi, John.
Hello, Larry.
Hi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I have a 6-year-old maple tree, and yesterday vanished to the bark all the way around, about 4 inches high on the bottom. How I can save it?
Oh, dear.
All the way around? Yeah, all the way around.
Yeah, although I'm really sorry to tell you this, but the tree's water conducting tissue is right underneath the bark. So typically if a rabbit removes the bark all the way around, it has removed all that water conducting tissue, so the tree can't actually pull anything up out of the soil, and it also can't transmit any food that is generated in the leaves through photosynthesis back down to the roots. So there's not really any way pr- practical to save that tree. Now, it might. Sometimes what I've seen is that it has enough stored energy in the system that it might bud out or it might leaf out a little bit, but then it usually dies after that. I hate to be the bearer of such bad news, but I don't think there's likely any way to save it.
And for the future, of course, if you get to put a new tree in there, maybe, what do you think, a little hardware cloth around the bottom of it?
I recommend that particularly for fruit trees and for young, thin bark trees like maples, because rabbits like to go for those. Hmm. If you get like a 24-inch tall roll of hardware cloth and use landscape staples to kind of staple it in around the base of the plant, being careful not to injure the trunk. And I usually use zip ties to close it on the sides. That's a really effective barrier for winter. And take it off.
And when you're putting that tree in, make it sure it's planted properly.
Yep.
So if you can, I would tend to start with a bare root tree if you can get one, and then make sure the root flare, which is where the trunk widens to form the root system, is right above the soil line, and make sure those roots are oriented so they don't wrap around the tree, because that can lead to girdling roots later on. I can't tell you how many samples come into my clinic where the issue is really not a disease, but it's poor planting from many, many years ago. So getting the tree established right now is going to help you prevent problems in the future.
Yeah, and the thing is, as you say, you don't notice it for 5 years or whatever, and then by that time,
10 or 15.
Yeah, and then you've forgotten how it was planted or don't know how it was planted, and it's best to get that done right the first time for sure. John, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And let's see, we've got Sharon in Berlin. Hi.
Hi. I've called in before several years ago, told you about what I'm going to tell you again. The best book on no-till gardening was written by Ruth Stout many years ago, S-T-O-U-T, and she mulched her garden, and it was mulched all the time. And I think she used hay, alfalfa, but I could be wrong there. But she never tilled after that. And the name of the book is How to Have a Green Thumb Without an Aching Back. You'll have to go to a good used bookstore, possibly a library, or just an old gardener like me that thinks that was one of the first books I ever read on gardening. But it tells you how to do it.
Well, I thank you very much for calling, Sharon. And I don't know if you've ever seen the video of Ruth Stout's garden. And I think it's available, so you can see it online. You type in Ruth Stout's garden. She had a great way of gardening. It didn't involve a whole lot of work. And once she had her mulch in there, and she just would come and throw, a lot of times just throw her potatoes, for example, just lift up the mulch, throw the potatoes in, and leave them be for the rest of the year. Thanks again, Sharon, for that. It's an old, old book, but there's a lot of good information in it, and the video is really fun to watch for sure. Well, Tammy and Madison, do you have a question?
You have the best show, 24 hours. You're the one that I pick out. So that being said, I listen all the time. You're my favorite. My question has to do with rehabbing sandy soil. So we are selling in Madison and looking to build elsewhere. We've got a plot, but it is the sandy loam, I believe you call it. And how do you overcome the sandy loam with a ton of invasives? And I'm sure you can picture what side of the state it is with the, I'm trying to remember the names of these invasive nettles and things that you don't want to touch, that you have to wear gloves. And it's 100% sand, so you have great water in your well, but it's impossible to grow anything. How would you recommend going about rehabbing that type of soil?
Got about 30 seconds or so for that.
Okay. I would say you might need to use some herbicides, possibly, if you don't mind using herbicides. If you do mind using herbicides, obviously you're going to have to dig and pull. Nettles usually like really wet soil, so I'm surprised you have nettles.
I might be using the wrong name, but...
Yeah, there's just add some organic material. That's the best way to rehab it.
Yeah,
okay,
and we can
talk.
Thank you very much for calling. Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston, our guests. Lisa, UW Extension Horticulture Educator. Brian, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. Don't forget to, by the way, to go to ideas@wpr.org/Larry for that survey to fill out. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, and Brian Huddleston. Brian is Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. So it's great to have them with us. Certainly, if you have a question, join in at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. I want to go back to that caller just before our break. She was asking about improving... Got some sandy soils, and I'm not sure. Lisa, you had to kind of rush that answer at the end. Anything else you wanted to add to that?
I mean, when you have a lot of weeds, it's really difficult, especially when you're wanting to improve the soil at the same time. So finding out what kind of weeds, whether they're annuals or perennials. If they're annuals, you might just be able to mow it and put either black tarp on it or possibly, you know, cardboard on it. Basically, you want to try and get rid of the weeds first before you add a lot of organic matter to improve the soil. Because every time that you till something in or mix it in, spade it in, whatever, you're bringing up more weed seeds. So finding out what you've got and taking some time to get rid of all the existing weeds is really important before you get a chance to actually improve that soil.
Yeah, good points. Luann in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Luann.
Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate
sure.
it. I'm actually calling for my sister. She brought home some house plants, and they ended up having what they call mealybugs on them. Oh. And we tried to do research, and we cannot find anything to get rid of them. And they, when they get full grown, they are white, and they got like a waxy cover on it. So the only thing that she's found to kill the adult is to spray them with alcohol, but they have like, they end up having like millions of babies in within like 3 days. So she cannot get rid of, she doesn't know how to get rid of them, and they're all over her house.
All over the house?
Yes. And she's kind of a hoarder because she has a lot of vintage things that she's, like I say, hoards it. And so, I mean, just to try and move stuff out of the house is just like unrealistic.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'd get rid of the plant if that's and any other house plants that she has, she should really think about possibly getting rid of if it's spread that much. But they are sucking insects, and they can't survive off of a plant. So I'm not quite sure why she's seeing them all over the house. They certainly can breed quickly, but they're not as bad as things like spider mites, for example. You can, if there are just a few of them, you can put rubbing alcohol on a Q-tip and touch it to the white nests and to the adults. But if you've got a ton of them, it's far better to use something like neem oil or insecticidal soap. And unfortunately, neither one of those products might kill all the eggs, so you probably would have to retreat. Also, these insects can sometimes get into the soil around right around the base of the plant and get into the roots. So it's just, I think with the amount that it sounds like you're talking about, that the easiest thing to do would be just to get rid of the plants and start over once there's a thorough cleaning that's done.
Yeah, I think you're right on that one. Good luck, Luann. Thank you very much for calling. Gary in Madison, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, hi, it's Gary. And I do have a question about my raspberry kind of things that I've had, probably 12 of the bushes.
Yeah.
And last year, they were fall. They're ones that, you're taking the fall. And last year, we just didn't have anything hardly coming out of them. They were very brittle. They were very old. I went out and I cut them all down all the way to the ground. Some of the actual whole plant came out of the ground. So what can I do with that ground now there?
So you've gotten rid of the plants.
What's that?
Did you get rid of the plants then completely?
Yeah, I mean, there's some still, in the ground that will come out very easily, but I had just cut them down. And I'm just wondering, should I pull all of that out of there? What can I do with that area now?
Yeah, I'm concerned given your comment that the plants are pulling fairly easily out of the ground, that they're probably have root and crown rot issues, which is probably what caused the patch to decline. And some of those organisms can survive in the soil for an extended period of time. I would improve once you get rid of the plants, I would be inclined to come in with some organic matter to improve the drainage and possibly because the root rot organisms tend to do better when it's relatively wet. You may want to leave it fallow for a couple of years before you put anything in, allow some time for those organisms to die off. Although again, they do survive a fair amount of time and it's hard to predict exactly what other crops you might be able to put in there. You may want to move away from producing any sort of crops in that area for a while and try to move your growing area to another part of your yard if that's an option for you. The root rot organisms are really tough to deal with. They have really thick walled resting spores that can last for years, if not decades, in certain situations.
Hmm. So improving the soil in that area in the long term may help, but...
May help, right. And what you're trying to do is keep it a little bit more on the dry side. So good drainage so you don't get a large buildup of high moisture levels, because those root rot organisms do better in wet soils.
Okay.
Thank you.
There you go. Yeah, thanks, Gary. Let's go to Pete next in Bellevue, Iowa. Hi, Pete.
Hi, great to talk to you all. I know that Brian's been good for me on a verticillium wilt tree where I'm located, but at any rate, have a smaller garden, 30 by 70, all in boxes, about 13 different boxes, 8 by 4 feet. Probably not rotating as well as I could be and should be, but I'm really struggling with green peppers and red peppers the last 3 years, especially. Just wondering if there's any other than a soil test, anything I'm overlooking, or they seem to come up 1 to 2 feet and then they just don't really thrive and create much fruit and basically fill out. So just kind of concerned about my peppers lately.
Hmm.
Are you planting them in the same bed every year?
No, I'm trying to rotate. Like I say, it's 30 by 70 garden with these boxes. Mm-hmm. I try to move them away from similar boxes, but maybe I haven't done as well as I could have.
Well, if you have followed those peppers with tomatoes or eggplants or potatoes, those are all in the same family. So I would make sure that you're rotating to different families. Are these sweet potatoes or sweet peppers or hot peppers or both?
Yeah, definitely sweet. Romas and some eating tomatoes, but not hot peppers at all.
Okay, so it's the sweet peppers that you're having problems with.
Right.
Yeah.
Either red or green. Mm-hmm.
Okay. They are very sensitive to not having appropriate heat. So if it has been in your area not very warm over the past couple summers, that could certainly have something to do with it. They also will, if you have a number of nights that are below 55, it will abort buds, not develop fruits. So it could be possibly weather-related. Other than that, just making sure that you have good, you know, fertility. And if you've had other things in that particular bed that have not done well, or set of beds, then I would be concerned about the soil.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and the timing of the planting, too. I mean, I don't even plant peppers in Madison until June, to be honest.
That's really good point, because if you put them out when it's too cold, they will just kind of sulk all summer, and they don't produce the fruit very well.
Yeah. You want to wait, think that you've waited long enough and then wait another week. That's my advice anyway, based on my own experience. Oh boy. Thanks, Pete. Appreciate it. Ray in Whitewater, your turn. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling to confirm what is my personal observation. That there's been a recent explosion in spruce needle cast disease. I think it's called Rhizophora fungal disease. I have on my property. I've noticed it all over the state. I have. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead. Finish up. My apologies.
Well, I just see it on my own property. I have trees that are 30 years old, and virtually all of them are succumbing to this disease. And as I drive around the state, even up to Ashland, I went this past fall. And maybe it's because I've seen it on my property that I seem to be observing it widespread around the state. I haven't seen any kind of bulletin or notice from the DNR on it. I just wondered if it's suddenly become a problem.
No, it's been a problem forever. I've been in the clinic over 20 years, and it's been the number one disease in my clinic probably since the first year I started. And we see this disease quite commonly, particularly on Colorado blue spruce, but we've been seeing it probably a little bit more on Black Hill spruce, which is a type of white spruce that years ago we thought it was relatively resistant, and so we were recommending that as a replacement tree. And it's turned out, as people have been growing more of that tree, that it's relatively susceptible as well. So I don't know that the disease has actually changed over time. I just think that as the trees age, they tend to get more severe cases of the disease. So you tend to notice it. And what you see with the disease is a lot of thinning, usually starting at the bottom of the tree from the inside at the trunk area out towards the tips and then moving up the tree. And there's not a lot you can do about it. The infections seem to occur in the spring around the time when the new needles are coming out. And the fungus tends to sit in that new foliage and doesn't really cause any symptoms. You only start to see the effects as the needles age and they get farther back in the canopy. And then the fungus causes premature needle drop. We really recommend, as a management tool, pruning up the branches as they start to thin to open up the canopy. And on existing trees, if they're not showing symptoms, I even recommend pruning out healthy branches to increase airflow so that things dry. And it's those drier conditions that tend to kind of suppress the activity of the fungus. And then when you go to replace the trees, use a wide diversity of different types of trees. Don't rely kind of solely on spruces. So if you want to go with evergreens, plants, you can plant some spruces, but also plant you know, pines and firs, and it really depends on your particular location and your soil conditions, but diversify, because we tend to see fewer problems with disease issues when you're growing a wide range of different types of plants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, good advice there for sure. Ray, good luck. Appreciate the call. Marjorie in the Shoto, your turn. Hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have a question about fire blight. I have two 20-year-old Chanticleer pears. They're just gorgeous trees, but one of them has about 30% damage from fire blight. The other maybe 10, 15%. I've been told I have to take them out, and I'm just getting a second opinion.
Yeah, if it truly is fire blight, and that's a disease where a lot of people diagnose fire blight when oftentimes that's not what it is. That particular disease, I always tell folks, if you want to make sure it's fire blight, you need to have a lab analysis and lab testing to confirm that. But if you're seeing a large proportion of the tree that's died back, whether it's fire blight or something else, you're getting to the point where normally with these sorts of diseases, we would suggest pruning out the disease branches, but with 30% of the canopy affected, you're going to end up with a tree that doesn't look very good. So I think you're better off probably removing the tree and replacing it. And if you are interested in replanting and planting something that can be susceptible to fire blight, look for resistant varieties and use those. But again, if you want to know for certain whether it's fire blight or not, you could get a sample into my clinic. We can test for you. I would wait until we get farther into the growing season. I think probably about the best time to test for that is around flowering, because that particular organism tends to be moved around by honeybees, and you'll start to see infections occurring at the points where the flowers are attached to the branches. And then usually there's a high enough number of the bacteria there that we can detect them. We use a little dipstick test. It's like kind of like the equivalent of a home pregnancy test, but it's designed to detect the bacterium that causes the disease. But there's a lot of misdiagnosis of fire blight going on, in my opinion. People see dieback in apples or pears or crab apples, and they immediately call it fire blight when oftentimes it is not.
One other thing to think about, though, is that a lot of the ornamental pears are ending up on the invasive species list.
Yep.
So that may be another reason that you've been asked to take them out. It's too bad, because they were really beautiful fall color, nice ornamental trees, but we're finding them seeding everywhere. And I suspect that if they're not on the invasive species list in this upcoming round, they will be shortly.
There you go, Marjorie. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Scott in Altoona emailed to say he's considering switching his starting seeds from fluorescent light bulbs to LED, and he's wondering, for the least expensive lights, is an LED shop light good, or should he look for something else?
Without knowing exactly what he means by an LED shop light, I mean, ideally you would want LED lights that have both the blue and the red spectrum in them. LEDs are really nice and energy efficient, and I think that in the future, I know the price has been coming down already, so I think we'll end up going to that in the future. There are a lot of different brands and spectrums that are available. If you can find something that is designed specifically for growing plants, that's obviously the best, if at all possible.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for that question, Scott. Somebody's wondering if it was safe to prune trees and shrubs in March yet, I guess. And a side question about oaks.
Yeah, sure. So the beetle that transmits oak wilt is active at 50 degrees. So you want the tree to be completely dormant, and you don't want a 50-degree temperature coming up anytime you know, within at least a couple of days of when you prune. Unfortunately, the temperatures have been getting pretty warm. So depending on where you are in the state, you may still be safe. But usually you want to make sure, especially with oaks and elms, that you don't prune too late in the season. So it's not necessarily the calendar date, it's the temperature. And it seems like we're getting a lot of warm temperatures right now.
We have some 50-degree days coming up in Madison area in the next 3 or 4 days, as a matter of fact.
If it's 30s or low 40s, I'd say, go ahead and do it. And you do need to make sure also that the buds aren't swelling.
Yeah. And if you're absolutely desperate and for some reason have to do it after that temperature threshold, then make sure you have a bucket of paint next to you when you make the cut and paint over the wound immediately. And I'm more concerned, quite frankly, about oaks than elms with pruning. It's really oak wilt that tends to be more of an issue with pruning at the wrong time of the year.
But and we only recommend pruning paint on oaks and elms, particularly during the growing season, if you've had storm damage and you have to prune at that time of year. But normally we don't recommend pruning paint for anything else.
But lilacs or something like that, you could prune those now, couldn't you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Other...
Once the buds start, you know, swelling, then it's not great to do it. But, yeah, you could certainly, with other things, still have a window.
All right. Well, on that note, here we are out of time again. I want to thank you both very much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And I know you guys are part of that survey that UW Extension is doing on how listeners use our Garden Talk radio program. And I just want to mention it one more time. It shouldn't take you more than a minute or two to fill out the survey about this particular show and what you may have learned from it. And you can go to gowisc.edu/radio. That's go.wisc.edu/radio. Or just go to wpr.org/Larry, and the link's over there on the right-hand side of the page. And take your minute or two and fill that out, your input. It helps in planning programs and topics and so forth, and Extension's interested in that. Well, Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston, our guests today. Lisa, the horticulture educator for Dane County. Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Great to have them with us. And, of course, they'll be back. We'll get them back, and we'll do this all over again. On Monday, Jesse LeGrew will be back to talk technology. He'll help us figure out how to dispose of old electronics and what to keep in mind when buying new ones. So I hope you'll join us on Monday for that. But in the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.